Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACC Retirement Trust. A couple of weeks ago, we received a press release from WSP USA announcing that Chris Harmon had been named the National Director of Digital Delivery and Innovation for Transportation at the firm. And we get a lot of press releases, and most of them are pretty run-of-the-mill, but this one struck a chord. We wondered what the position would entail and what kind of innovation they were talking about. So we reached out to WSP USA, and with us today to talk about what he plans to do in the position is Chris Harmon. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So as the new National Director of Digital Delivery and Innovation for Transportation, what is that?
Yeah, it's a lot, right? A good question, one that even I struggle with sometimes, but I would say there's two sides to it. And one is internal facing, right? Because, you know, as an organization, there is a need to upskill our workforce, modernize delivery. We have threats coming from, you know, the regular players, AEC firms of our size that are delivering for clients and they're using new methods that we want to keep up with. But we also have some kind of threats coming from smaller startups. As technology has changed, it's really starting to drive home to our clients the value they can get from the information they're producing. And they're starting to ask for different things. And that means that we need to look internally and build ourselves up to enable to meet that challenge. And then on the other side of that coin is the external facing, right? So this is about the services that we offer, right? Maybe we could expand some services. It's also about the pursuits and opportunities, the way we approach those, you know, how we respond to client needs, the things that we say, the things that we do, and the projects that we're delivering. At its core sense, digital delivery is about, you know, changing our process for delivery to be more efficient. And if we're delivering projects for clients where we're seeing a lot of rework or we're seeing a lot of issues during construction, there's a lot of changes we can make just in the basic generic way that we deliver. That's going to make it easier for us to get the client outcomes that we want, do it in an efficient manner, you know, preserve quality, all those things. So,
yeah, digital delivery seems to be a bit of a buzzword right now. How does this take it out of being a buzzword and being something? I mean, this is a corporate position, for example. How does it become more than just something you to check a box?
Well, let me try to put it maybe into a little bit of context. For the two sides I was just talking about, internal and external, and why this is a corporate position, what we see is, you know, let's say that I got asked to look at a project. The project was having some margin erosion. You know, they were losing some money, or there were a lot of issues during construction, and we wanted to come in and look at it from a digital lens. Part of what I do is look at the process for delivery, the way that we're producing information, the way we're exchanging it. If I see things like a lot of static exchanges, like emailing files to each other, you know, when we do that, we kind of open ourselves up for somebody to be working on out-of-date information. Or that also means that the communication is not great because we don't have dynamic links. We're not actually connecting the information together, we're kind of waiting on someone to reach out and grab it, which means they could be completely missing everything. So I'll come in and they'll say, hey, we don't work that way, right? This is not an efficient way to deliver. This is opening ourselves up to some risk. And what happens is a project team, whether it's internal or external, will say, show me where it says that, right? I hear you telling me that this is not how we work, but show me where it says how we work. And so that external project, you know, that external thing that maybe needs some adjustments to its delivery, it needs that internal focus. It needs somebody to sit down and say, you know what? We're going to dynamically connect information together. We're going to work in a cloud environment. We're going to change the way we exchange information. We're not going to rely on static exchanges. We're going to be explicit about this. We're going to write it down, internal procedures. And maybe we're going to adopt some tools. We're going to invest in some tools, some development on our own to enable that on projects. This is kind of a natural progression. And what you'll see in most corporations is that there are groups that are doing this, right? There are teams that are investing in this, you know, they're upskilling their people, they're changing the way they deliver because they can see the need, right? It's just modern delivery. There are teams that are not. And the need for it at a corporate level is because we don't want to reinvent this wheel in pockets all over the business. Because what I'm talking about, this kind of collaborative working information exchanges, it doesn't matter if it's a water project or a rail project or a highways project. And this is a need that we all have. And if we don't look at it in a global perspective, right, then what we're going to end up is investing in it in these pockets all over the place in a million different ways with a million different tools. And when you end up needing a resource, right, on your project, and you call, you know, California or Oregon or New York State, and you say, I need somebody to come and help me, they're going to come and they're going to have no idea where to start. They won't have used this tool. They don't use this workflow. And so, you know, you're investing in it multiple times. It's inefficient. It's hard to expand your workforce. It's hard to work share. These are all kind of like, you know, alarm bells ringing. We need some governance here, right? We need some oversight to help put this stuff together. And I'm talking about this kind of global rigidity, but it really needs regional flexibility. It needs discipline flexibility. There's got to be some way for these teams to do what their clients are expecting, but within a framework. And so the corporate need there is there because the projects need it. We know we have to change. And so what I'm doing is I'm coming in, I'm saying, okay, well, we're going to do this differently. There's an expectation for a collaborative working. There's expectations for, you know, managed information exchanges. Here's where we wrote it down. Now, what do you need for your client? How are we going to do it for you? And then try to kind of instill that in that team. And that's how we kind of bring that internal facing, those standards, all that governance, the stuff that nobody wants to do and write down, and that external facing, that delivery, keeping the client happy, making it fit for that client need, kind of bringing all that together in a way that we're not reinventing it every time, you know, that this is a standard that people expect.
And is it a case of taking up, you know, the best practices from Oregon and best practices from New York and sort of finding some sort of place where you have a uniform best practice?
Yes, actually there is a international standard for architecture, engineering, consulting, digital delivery on projects, ISO 19650. It's kind of an interesting story because in the United Kingdom, they decided that they were going to make it a requirement that all government dollars are delivered in BIM-centric, right? Model BIM information management-centric workflow. And they created a British standard 1192, which turned into PAS 1192. So it was kind of this adopted British standard for information delivery on architecture, engineering, construction projects. And that case, the UK government deciding that this was going to be a thing in 2010, basically, is how we kind of modernized the world, because that standard has basically been incorporated into an ISO standard now. And in America, right, we're, you know, obviously we don't have to follow a British standard or even an ISO standard necessarily. NIBS has recently said that they're gonna base their deliveries on that. It's the National Institute of Building Sciences. And, you know, they look after whole building design guide and universal facilities criteria. So, you know, you can almost see, if you kind of crystal ball a little bit, you can see a world where down the road, you know, federal dollars are going to require a BIM-centric workflow, an information managed workflow, which is an exciting time because it's, you know, it's a complicated standard and, you know, not many people have read it, but at its heart, it's just basic delivery. I mean, I think that most project managers would read it and go, oh yeah, I mean, that's what we're doing, right? How else would we do this? But to have the standard and to have it clearly set out a need for managed information, it's kind of an exciting time to be me, really.
And why transportation? Is it behind the times? Is it ahead of the times?
Ooh, it's got a different set of needs. So I'm going to dodge that. You know, buildings were first. Commercial have been on this kind of workflow for a long time, but their needs are different. You know, a developer wants to develop that commercial development for as little money and time as possible and then sell it on, right? They do not have an operational need normally. This isn't always the case. And so a BIM-centric delivery, you know, information management for buildings and commercial, although they've been doing it for a long time and they kind of modernized this idea of information exchanges for facilities, you know, the assets operate in kind of a different life cycle than, say, transportation. If you look at a port or a transit agency or an airport, I mean, they're effectively cities, right? They have so much infrastructure and assets they need to maintain. And the life cycle is a lot longer. They're starting to realize the value of the data that's being created, what it means for them in operations. You know, if you look at operational costs as opposed to capital costs, I mean, it's, you know, order of magnitude larger. And they're really starting to identify that need now and extend it out. And although I guess they are maybe a little bit behind, if I do answer the question, you know, they're thinking bigger, they're thinking longer. It's a much bigger problem to solve. And if I extrapolate that out one more to say like a State Department of Transportation, I mean, these assets last for hundreds of years, you know, 50, 100 years. They're kind of slow moving, you know, the kind of pavements and bridges, you know, the kinds of things that they worry about, you know, they're out there for a long time. There's not a lot of change on them, but they also own and operate those assets, right? So that the value to them is much bigger long-term and they're thinking long-term. And, you know, to really, I guess, answer the question, I am seeing, or we are seeing, real groundswell in our transportation clients, mostly because I think one or two of them started doing it. And now everybody's kind of doing it. They can all see this and they're all kind of driving us toward it.
Is digital delivery and is it a lot about tools, having the right sort of digital tools?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I would caution everyone against taking a tool focus. What I always advocate for is a persona focus, a user needs focus. You know, if you start with your client and you start mapping out personas and you say, I am a facilities manager and I need to know when this piece of equipment will fail. The last time this failed, shut down operations for 3 days. We couldn't order the part. I gotta know in advance. That's a user need. That's a use case that we can design a system around. You know, when we are designing this asset, we can say, oh, they need to know about this piece of equipment. Let's capture some information on that. This is a key one, right? And let's add some sensors or let's add some simulations so that we can understand when it's expected to fail. And then at the very end of it, let's figure out a tool that's gonna let them see it, right? Or a tool that's going to let us do it. If we work that way, we get to tools at the end, and you can't do it without the tools. I mean, you're going to need to make a selection, right? The difference, though, in this kind of starting with the user and with that end use case in mind is that if you start with the tools, which is this is how we actually do it, which is kind of what I've spent a lot of time fighting against. You start with the tools and you collect a bunch of information that you may or may not need. And then at the very end, you say, now, what would you like to do with all this great stuff I've just done? And they ask for something that's not in what you've got. You end up kind of like standing there with a crowbar or a sledgehammer and trying to like shove this tool into the need, right? Get what they wanted out of it, even though it's not quite right. And I mean, it just leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth. It slows it all down. The client had expected this one thing and they got something else. Expectations aren't met. And so I caution people from kind of starting with the tool. Reality though is, you know, tools are pretty cool, right? It looks cool and there has to be some eye candy and it has to actually get done. And so it needs to be done that way. But, you know, if we could shift that focus to an end use or an end need, I think it would make the tools much more powerful.
What about the WSP team? I mean, how do they play into this? Do you need to educate them? Do you need to, what do you need to do with the team?
Yes, absolutely. I think, well, as I said at the beginning, I mean, there are pockets of people that have already started this, that are doing it, and there are pockets that aren't. And upskill and training is huge. And it's going to be more and more important because those end user needs, those client needs that are starting to come to us in contracts and new types of contracts, as we start to see those, we're going to be asked to deliver stuff we haven't delivered before, and we're going to need people to do it, right? So we're going to have to invest internally in training and in standards to train against. and to grow our people. I think that there's an added benefit here because it's going to help us retain our people. You know, it's going to make them feel like they're keeping up with modern times. It's going to make them feel valuable. I see a lot of value in kind of being a part of this digital shift and this change. And, you know, people don't like change, but if we can do it together in a managed way, and everybody knows expectations are set, and we're not just asking them to change and then giving them no tools or training, then I think it's going to help. And there's another side to this people question I'll just add on. I think if we're making the right investments in our own people and we're seen as a place where it's progressive in its delivery and it's, you know, we're investing in our people to meet modern demands, it's going to make it easier for us to hire, right? And so, you know, not just retention, but also, you know, this appeal to the wider market. It's a tough market out there right now. And there's a real need for people. And when talent is key, any edge we can give ourselves is going to be critically important. And if we shift our focus off of the development internal, it's also going to make us less desirable to the external.
It's an excellent point, because labor is such an issue for us right now.
Mm-hmm.
What about with the clients? You mentioned, you know, making sure that you're meeting their needs. To any degree, are you educating the clients about what this is and what this can do for them?
Absolutely. You know, they want to know what other agencies are doing just like them. So one of the things that we do more than anything really is go around and explain to some clients what we're doing with other clients. But they also want to know what's possible. I think, you know, when we think about contracts and we think about legal requirements and, you know, modern delivery and the changing methods of, you know, procurement, all of these things are starting to get wrapped into digital a little bit. Clients are seeing a need to change the way that they deliver and what they ask for. And, you know, we're trying our best to make sure that we're keeping them up to date with what's going on. And there's a desire from them to see that. And there's also I think lately, over the last year or so, has been a real almost exponential shift in their working knowledge of this space. I mean, they know they need it and they know they want it and they're looking for it. They're coming to us with specific needs. They're starting to set out RFPs for digital delivery, you know, for digital twins and for asset and information management kind of combined. And inside of all of this is kind of an old, maybe a problem that hasn't really gone away, but it's starting to be acknowledged. And that is the siloed nature to the way that we deliver and operate assets. You know, if you think about capital, and inside of capital is split between design and construction, and then you think about operations, so CapEx and OpEx, you know, the client meetings and projects we'll deliver in the future, there will be maintenance staff in the design team design rooms, and there will be facilities managers in construction, and there will be construction managers in operations. And those like disparate silos that never would touch are starting to get melded together because there is an acknowledgement that for any of this stuff that we're doing to be valuable to the other, we're going to have to start working together. And the client presentations that we're doing more now are to operations staff, you know, to the maintenance groups, to talk about what we're doing in design and construction and what they see when they actually try to operate, and vice versa. So that's an area that's been really exciting, I think, if we think about, you know, clients and that change is this kind of acknowledgement that maybe it's not two separate kind of buckets that will never meet.
In that melding of the buckets, I mean, does this open up opportunities for new services from your firm that you can offer clients, or even like, you know, new payment systems? For example, we were at our fall conference last week, and someone was talking about potential for subscription service. Mm-hmm. Is there these opportunities because of this?
I think so. Well, there needs to be, right? I mean, if you look at software providers, especially in the AEC space, many of them have, you know, 10 times the annual revenue with a tenth of the staff. And they do it because it's recurring revenue, right? That's the value of their business. And, you know, the commoditization or becoming a commodity is more and more of a reality for our industry. And the value and the changes we're talking about are long-term, and it's information that is being, that the value of that is life cycle, it's long-term. What we don't want to do is kind of work ourselves out of this process and just author at the beginning and hand it off and then be done. Clients are going to need to come to the table with us too, because, you know, I spend a lot of time preaching design automation. And if we spend a ton of time on a design automation graph that takes, you know, 12 hours of clicks and turns it into 20 seconds, and we can reuse that once a week and we can reuse it on the next project, where a client was paying us time and materials, this does not make a lot of sense for us, right? They're going to have to share in some of this value, which is how I would put it, because they're seeing a value here, so are we. They're going to have to come up with that. So, you know, a recurring revenue example there might be revenue that's gained every time that that button is clicked, and it can be shared across their entire consulting teams. Or if we're authoring, if our information that we're authoring, or if our design includes some configuration. So if you think about like a hospital bedroom, the way that the beds are created in the hospital, you know, that means they can see so many patients an hour, it makes it efficient. As long as that configuration is in the hospital, there's recurring revenue, or traffic pattern, or signal timing. You know, there's plenty of opportunities here for us to start introducing recurring revenue. And this is without ever touching on this concept of us as the engineering consulting groups authoring data and then providing that to the owners in a usable format. I mean, there's an entire business line where we build platforms ourselves, or we partner with platforms to provide that service to a client. And we offer hosting, data curation, data management, engineering, you know, customization. And we become that long-term kind of subscription-based provider. And it's not any one of these, and it's not all of them. It's some combination depending on the client and the need. But the concept of time and materials is going to have to go away if we're ever going to move forward.
And to close up here, what are some challenges that you see that this whole move towards digital delivery poses for engineering firms?
I think I usually have to convince people this isn't a problem, but I'll start with legal problems. I'll play their side. And then two fronts here, right? And one would be contracts. There just aren't enough contracts out there, example contract language about how digital can work integrated across all these different teams. We talk about integrated project delivery, And we get excited about this new idea of how we're going to deliver a project and managed information. And I can draw a technology architecture map of all the different tools and infrastructure where information is stored and how it's exchanged from pre-planning through operations. But then somebody comes through with a big red marker and starts drawing contract lines through it. And it just makes it almost impossible. When those red lines start going through, well, there's really no need for me to push this piece of information over here until I hit this trigger, and maybe I'm not at all. And it just really slows things down. And there's a lot of risk, right? And that there aren't enough examples yet of how we're going to get through it. It takes a leap of faith, and construction contracts, you know, those people aren't, they're not big on leaps of faith. So it's going to need an owner to pick that risk up, right? It's going to have to go somewhere. And if we're really going to see the benefits, somebody's going to have to put their hand up and say, I believe that this is going to work, and I'm going to accept some responsibility for, I'm going to take the all your worries away. And that is hard. And that is going to be a challenge. And then on the other side, away from contracts, in a paper world where we were delivering plans or PDFs, it was really easy to say, I'm, you know, the architect and engineer, and I have a contract with this contractor, you know, or this owner, and I don't have any responsibility to that sub-consultant. And what they did with the information on my plans was way outside what it should have been used for. I mean, this is pretty easy stuff to claim. But when you hand a model off that includes so much information, I mean, so much beyond what's on the plans, is it reasonable for a subcontractor somewhere down the supply chain to assume that the information in this model is fit for them to do fabrication from or fit for them to actually use during construction? I mean, it looks reasonable. It looks like somebody spent their time on it. And it starts to get real gray about what we can say this thing is used for and it's not used for, you know? And unfortunately, it starts to turn into it's either completely worthless or it's a massive risk. And there, it's almost like there's no in between. And we've really got to get away from that. We really have to say at the very beginning what it's going to be used for and what it's not and who can use it and what they can use it for. And it's a hard conversation to have because it just, you know, it gets complicated really quick. And I don't think the problem is necessarily any worse than it was when we were in paper. It's just, it feels worse. And it's grown in its scale, maybe. And we're not out of the woods yet. We just need a little more time to help build these really good models for how to do it and what to expect and what language we need to put in there to kind of make sure that everybody knows where the risk is really sitting. So I'd say that's a challenge that I'm optimistic about because the value is there. And where the value is, we will figure out a way to make it work.
Yeah, I think that that's the key point, that the value is there. So the smart people will figure it out. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to the Engineering Influence Podcast presented by ACEC and sponsored by the ACEC Retirement Trust. Thanks for listening.